You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Emma Louise Fenlon.
On the 12th of January this year, the Irish Commission of Investigation into Mother and Baby Homes published its long-awaited report. It comprises 3,000 pages, covering a period between 1922 and 1998, and investigated 18 institutions, touching on the lives of 56,000 mothers and 57,000 children. Reading and listening to the coverage of survivors' responses since its publication, it's hard to wrap one's head around the sheer scale and cruelty of what it describes. The Taoiseach, or Irish Prime Minister, Micheál Martin, when giving a state apology the day after publication, said the report described a dark, difficult and shameful chapter of Irish history, revealing a country that had a stifling, oppressive and brutally misogynistic culture. I am honoured that Mairead Enright, reader in feminist legal studies at Birmingham Law School, has agreed to talk to me about the report. Mairead, you're very welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell listeners a little bit about what were mother and baby homes?
So mother and baby homes were institutions in Ireland which in one form or another had been inherited from sort of the colonial regime pre-independence, but which were retained and adapted and persisted well into the 90s in Ireland. And they were places where women who had become pregnant but who were not married by and large went to live prior to the birth and for some time after the birth. People's experiences vary widely, and that's important to understand. But what the kinds of things that most people associate with the mother and baby homes are institutionalization and dispersal of children, and sometimes longer term institutionalization of their mothers. So sometimes, for example, women who had given birth in a mother and baby home, if they couldn't or weren't permitted to return to the wider community or emigrate, they might be sent to another institution like a psychiatric hospital or a Magdalen laundry, which was a kind of religious institution of penance. And children, depending on their status, were often adopted, but it was also common for them to be retained within the mother and baby homes for a period and then possibly passed on to other institutions, for example, industrial schools. Some were also fostered, or we might say boarded out, within the local communities, and many children who were boarded out did not have positive experiences and were exploited for their labour and so on. But again, people had a variety of very individual experiences. One thing that it might be worth pointing out is that a number of families, I mean, the mother and baby homes, because it involves both mothers and children, of course, there's an inherent intergenerational issue there. But it's also important to recognise that sometimes multiple generations of families would go through these institutions. So, for example, you might be born in a mother and baby home, sent on to an industrial school. When you got older, sent to a Magdalen laundry, you get pregnant, you're sent back to the mother and baby home, for example. And so in some families, it's grandparents, parents and children who've been affected, or multiple siblings and so on. And as that example tells you, some people were in different institutions as well. You know, you might have been in several institutions. So this is what James Smith at Boston College, he talks about Ireland's architecture of containment. So Ireland had a very heavy reliance on institutionalization as a way of managing the perceived social problem of unmarried motherhood and the perceived social problems around. Actually, the industrial schools weren't just about the children of unmarried mothers. They were also about containing children of people who were perceived not to be parenting appropriately for a range of different reasons. Equivalent institutions existed across the common law world, and they existed here in Britain as well. So this isn't necessarily uniquely Irish, but there is a sense in which the scale of use of these institutions in a very small country has sort of marked Irish culture in a way that required a response.
Lots of people will have heard of the film Philomena and the experience as it was depicted by Dame Judi Dench. But it's right to say, isn't it, that the UK has a real connection to these mother and baby homes, if only because thousands of women travelled to the UK and the authorities in the UK struggled to know what to do with them, with varying degrees of regard for their welfare.
Yeah, there's And this is mirrored in Philomena Lee's story. There are lots of ways in which the UK is connected. One is that sometimes women, rather than remain in Ireland for different reasons, would try to go to England, whether in an attempt to raise the child or just to give birth in England and have the child adopted in Britain, or just to give birth and then bring the child back to Ireland to be adopted. And there were, and the report spends a chapter on this actually, there were Catholic organisations, for example, in Britain, whose self-appointed function, though with the tolerance of both states, was to repatriate women who came to Britain for the purposes of having their babies here. And of course, as well, many women, once they got free of the institutions, emigrated to Britain, feeling that they had been exiled from Ireland, feeling that Ireland had done them an irreparable harm and that it wasn't safe to go back. And that's an injury that's only recently being repaired, as there's a kind of a heightened public attention on these issues. And there have been sort of various events attempting to make reparation for aspects of the harms that were done to these women.
But for those unfamiliar with the Mother and Baby Home Commission itself, can you describe the significance of the report published last week and the state's response to it?
Okay, so the Mother and Baby Homes Commission is a commission of investigation. It is one in a series of such investigations. So the other institutions I mentioned earlier, the Magdalen Laundries, the industrial schools, they have been the subject of prior inquiries. So there's a kind of a fragmentation here, but it was perceived to be the latest or possibly the last in a series. And it's chaired by Judge Yvonne Murphy, who had previously chaired similar inquiries for the state. And her co-commissioners were two historians and a specialist, well, a legal historian and a social historian, and the legal historian being a specialist in family law. And it's difficult to describe its functions because it's not making findings of guilt or innocence. It's not reviewing past court cases or miscarriages of justice. What it's doing is it's presenting what it calls a social history of the institutions. Generally, first of all, then focusing on a selection of 18 institutions, which is just more than 10%, let's say, of the total number. And then based on that social history, it makes certain findings. And those findings are not framed in terms of a human rights analysis. So it's not asking, for example, has there been a breach of the right to life here? Or has there been a breach of the right to family life? It's making certain findings which it presents as findings of fact. And it's come to a number of very controversial conclusions. Now, the significance of that is it's important to understand how these kinds of commissions and inquiries have been used in Ireland in relation to those other historical injustices. The state has a method now. It commissions a social history, and that social history is treated as the evidence base for future state action. And in particular, the state uses these inquiries to produce an official account of how serious and widespread particular wrongs were. And then if they were sufficiently serious and sufficiently widespread that the state has reason to fear mass litigation, and that means individual cases because class actions are very difficult to bring in Ireland, it will set up some form of alternative dispute resolution. Usually that's quite a fancy name for it. Usually it's a bureaucratic process by which people can apply for some form of redress. And so that's why this report is so important. It's not simply the official narrative that we might have hoped, had things been different, would give people some measure of recognition. It's what legal consequences might flow from the report in terms of the actions the state is willing to take in terms of potential reparations.
Reading the 200-page executive summary, several things in particular stood out and shocked me. The first was that the commission found no evidence of sexual and very limited evidence of physical abuse. And secondly, no evidence that women were forced to enter mother and baby homes by the church or state authorities, but rather the report placed the mistreatment suffered by women and girls, some of whom were as young as 12, at the feet of the families, fathers and society generally. And so perhaps unsurprisingly, in light of that, the response to the report's publication has been overwhelmingly negative. Can you explain why that is?
I think there is something profoundly privatising in that last aspect of the conclusion. You know, Micheál Martin said in one of his responses, We did this to ourselves. We have to understand that we did this to ourselves. There was no foreign power that required us to say to our unmarried daughters, you can't stay at home, you can't keep your child, you can't even remain here for the duration of your pregnancy. You have to be hidden away in this institution where you will give birth in secret and your child will be ideally adopted into this closed system and we won't have to worry about them again. There was some, Micheál Martin says, you know, there was no dominant force that told us that. But of course, that's a very simplistic analysis. It's one that's consistent, of course, with the privatizing ethos of a very neoliberal government. But it's very simplistic because when you go into the testimonies, which are paraphrased and presented in the report, or even when you think about sort of the common sense of these issues, how people in Ireland today understand them, of course, they understand that there was estrangement and violence and difficulty within families. But they also recognise, and women's testimony repeatedly says this in the report, and the report acknowledges this, whatever we want to call it, women did not feel that they were free to do as they wished with their pregnancies and with their potential parenthood. And there are all kinds of reasons for that. One was the overwhelming stigmatisation of unmarried motherhood by the church and by the state. For example, in Ireland, and this isn't unusual, but it's worth pointing out, it wasn't until the 1970s that any form of welfare payment was available to women raising a child on their own. So there was no economic support. The institutional provision for unmarried motherhood was this secret, disciplinary, carceral framework. Unmarried motherhood in social policy was also presented as a failing. You know, the report is full of discourse around, you know, women who were pregnant twice without being married were called repeat offenders by some local authorities, for example, very much that criminal language. So, and the state legislated in ways which stigmatised unmarried parenthood. For example, the status of illegitimacy was not removed from Irish law until well into the 80s. Adopted people today in Ireland still don't have the same right to access their birth certificate as everybody else. So I think people could see very quickly that a complex issue of interacting factors, which meant that people had very different experiences depending on their age, their race, their class, the decade in which they got pregnant and so on, that the report had dramatically oversimplified that relationship and said this is primarily down to these women's fathers and the men who got them pregnant. And the last point, the men who got them pregnant, is a very difficult one because, of course, Ireland was and still is, to some degree, a patriarchal society, as other societies are. Men and women suffered very different consequences for pregnancy outside of marriage. At the same time, we know from social histories and from testimonies that men who wanted to keep their children were not permitted to do so. And that the social alternatives were very limited. You know, is the report saying instead of forced adoption, we should have had more forced marriage? You know, there's a real lack of complexity, empathy and compassion in that analysis.
One of the other things that struck me for its absence was criticism of the Catholic Church. And I was struck by Fintan O'Toole's article describing, as he put it, the spiritual terrorism that existed during this period. But why do you think the report seems to sidestep putting the blame, or at least a significant part of the blame, at the foot of the Catholic Church in Ireland?
I think probably because it's quite a difficult thing to do with the simplicity that the report seems to desire. If you think about the whole sweep of time that the report is considering, from 1922 all the way down to 1998, the shape of church institutions changes dramatically in that time period, particularly at the end, for example, as people start to question, you know, issues around the sexual morality of the church and hypocrisy and damage in that area. So I think it's quite difficult to boil down the many different shapes that the church took in that whole period into one easy soundbite. I think a second thing perhaps is, and this is welcome to some degree if the report did it properly, is that culture, that terrorising culture that Fintan O'Toole talks about. It was certainly, some of its origins were religious. Some of the structures that held it in place were religious. We have documented testimonies where individual religious agents inflicted violence, applied duress, did shaming things, directly prevented families from resisting separation and so on. But at the same time, that isn't just a story of people with dog collars or people wearing habits. In order for that system to remain, it also had to have advantages for lawyers, judges, social workers, doctors, nurses, who had local authority members, county councillors, who relied on the church for support and bought into its kind of economy of respectability. So I think the report is kind of hamstrung, because when you tell that story, it becomes really clear you can't just point to any particular bishop or priest. And you're talking about a complex and interconnected social system. And I think it didn't really have, and you know, several social historians and feminist historians have come out to question the methods of the report. I think the frameworks that it was using weren't equipped to speak to the complexity of that power. So I don't think it doesn't blame the church, but it can't describe really in any convincing way what was going on.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the report does ultimately recommend and where that leaves survivors seeking redress?
Okay, so there are a number of different issues in terms of what survivors have been asking for over the last 5 years while they were waiting for this report to be prepared. One is in relation to access to different forms of information and records. A second is in relation to what is going to be done about the children and women who died in the homes, many of whom, you know, people may have heard the story of Chum Mother and Baby Home in the west of Ireland, you know, many of whom are buried in unmarked graves, which do not identify the people who have been buried there, still on institutional property, while family members who know they had relatives in the homes have expressed an interest in identifying them and moving from there. And then the last thing is financial redress. Maybe we'll talk about financial redress first. The things that you said earlier when you were summarising the report, it doesn't recognise that adoption was forced. It doesn't recognise women were in institutions against their will. It doesn't categorise the abuses that took place there as physical or sexual. All of those fudges and missteps in the report, those are important because, and this is especially evident from the recommendations on financial redress, it proposes very limited financial redress for a very small group of people. So, for example, it doesn't propose that any money should be available to any woman who gave up her child for adoption after 1973, because after 1973, the state provides unmarried mother's allowance, right? So because it doesn't recognise that adoptions in that period were still not consensual, done with full, free and informed consent, it doesn't think such women should be entitled to financial redress. And there are other examples in terms of, you know, often with a redress scheme, you would have a base payment, a common experience payment, and then you would have additional amounts for individual experiences. That second part of the scheme is very sketchy. And because certain kinds of harm, you know, physical abuse, racism, discrimination against disabled children and so on, because they have been dismissed or denied, then they don't appear as a potential sites of additional payment. Now, it may be, though I doubt it from its existing practice, it may be that the government is expecting some survivors will want to go to court to seek additional financial and other redress. That remains to be seen. But certainly you can see a very clear line of reasoning from this emphasis on money and this emphasis, I suppose, on survivors as undeserving, effectively. The report says you're complaining about nothing. Now you're asking us for money. You know, you can see the discourse. And that's one that has played out in the treatment of people who have been applicants to previous historical injustice redress schemes. So that's definitely one to watch.
One of the most problematic things about the report and the events it describes is their understanding in popular consciousness. And I include my own understanding of this until recently as, quote, historical, unquote, crimes. So the idea that these things happened in the past before society and possibly even laws at the time knew any better. The first thing to say to that is obviously that we know from the timeline that these things were still going on up until 1998. But Dr. Maeve O'Rourke, who will be well known to anyone involved in this area, has argued powerfully that international human rights law ought to recognise the harms perpetrated against both mothers and babies that experience these homes as harms perpetrated that are ongoing and continuing. What do you say to that?
Okay, that's an intuitively appealing argument because we can see when we listen to survivors that things that happened even many decades ago have genuine effects on their everyday lives, particularly in relation to family separation. A number of people who were adopted under that system, for example, have come out and said, I want at the very least to know who gave birth to me. I want to know their name. And other people have told stories of difficulty in making contact with their parents, their natural parents or first parents, birth parents, who were willing to meet with them had they only been able to make contact. And so that kind of continuing loss, as well, of course, as the losses of people who are struggling because they don't know where siblings or parents are buried, for example, those are things that are deeply felt by people in the present and that are affected by current Irish law. So when we talk about continuing harms, it's very important to know where we are placing the responsibility, because some politicians will say, and indeed the report itself says at one point, why should people in Ireland today have to pay for the failings of previous generations? But that's not what survivors are saying. They're saying, hang on, the current impasses to, let's say, families. You know, if we do believe that our grandfathers and our fathers were to blame, then shouldn't the state be enabling people to make their own reparations to each other? For example, by deciding if they want contact or not, or by deciding if they want somebody to be reburied in a family plot and have a ceremony for them. The state's laws at the moment prevent any of that from happening. And that's the state's laws today. We had a debate about people's access to their institutional records just before Christmas. We have had adoption information and tracing legislation appear before the Oireachtas and fall apart because it was so far from what survivors wanted. So governments talk about this as legacy issues. If the adoption information issue is a legacy, it's a legacy from like 6 months ago. Do you know, like this stuff is constantly being debated in Ireland over and over again in the last 12 months, the last 24 months. So that's why it is so important that people recognise that responsibility.
So where does this leave the rights of survivors to access their personal data?
So several lawyers, and not just people who've been directly involved with survivors, but data protection lawyers, right, ordinary commercial data protection lawyers, have pointed out that GDPR is the law in Ireland, as it is elsewhere in the European Union, that it is very difficult to think of a kind of piece of information that is closer to the core of personal data than the name you were given when you were born, right? And so they have argued that under existing Irish law, people should be able to access a great deal, actually, of their early life and certainly their birth information. That position is heavily contested within the government. And so at the moment, in terms of advocacy, it feels like there's a little bit of movement around the birth certificate itself. And then there may need to be a separate legislative battle around additional early life information. For example, information about who raised you during the first 6 months of your life. That would be an example. It is possible very quickly to give people access to their birth certificates. In Ireland, your birth certificate is a matter of public record. And so what that means is if, for example, your adoptive parents knew your birth mother's surname, it's very easy for you to, or has historically been easy for you to get your birth certificate. Or if you do one of those ancestry DNA tests and through that you find a second or third cousin. So there's a burden that's currently being placed on people. TUSLA, which is the government body that has responsibility for processing people's applications for that data, has applied various balancing tests, redacted information given to people, treated them just very badly. And so there may be a bit of movement around the birth certificates, and then we will need to have potentially legislative action on other forms of information. But we would argue that that will just be clarifying existing Irish law and the application of existing Irish law. And that's progress, because before Christmas, people were talking about a referendum. There was a suggestion that the constitutional right to privacy of the birth mother would automatically trump the right to identity of her child. After that, there are more complex issues around other kinds of information, but it's perhaps worth paying attention to some proposals which are also gaining ground, that there should be a national centre on the site of one of these institutions, which should be a central archival repository, so that in a decade, for example, people who have a family history with these institutions would be able to go to a one-stop shop with trained archivists who would be able to produce for them a file of every institutional contact that they had or that their mother had in that period. So there is scope for progress. The government is certainly on the back foot. I don't think they expected the overwhelming negative response from the public. And so there's a real potential for momentum here to undo some of the harm by the publication of this report.
It's an important point that this report is, of course, only a starting point rather than its own end. And I would like to mention the CLAM project, which was a collaboration between the Adoption Rights Alliance, Justice for Magdalene's Research, and Hogan Lovells International, which gathered evidence that considered survivor testimony involving 182 institutions. So if you think about that in the context of this particular report, which only looked at 18, again, the scale of that is so shocking. And I wonder, where do you see this going next, this overall justice project?
So I'm not a member of the CLAN project, but as an academic, I find it a really interesting model with huge potential. So there's a couple of things. You know, when you pointed out the statements that they took from survivors, those statements were submitted to the commission, and the commission asked that they be converted into affidavits. And so that gave them an evidentiary status that was denied to other survivors who testified to the confidential committee of the commission. And so by providing that pro bono advice and support, the CLAN project made a real difference to the few survivors who could be heard and whose evidence had to be taken seriously as part of the main report. It's a pity the numbers were so small, but the difference in treatment is evident to anybody who opens the report. So that's number one. Number two, and Dr. Maeve O'Rourke, who is the director of the CLAN project, often says this. The report that the CLAN project produced and submitted officially to the commission while its inquiry was still ongoing takes a human rights analysis, breaks down all of the injuries and harms that were reported by the people they interviewed, the survivors they interviewed, and analyses them in terms of international and European human rights obligations, which, as I've said kind of earlier, we've alluded to earlier anyway, the commission dismisses as an activity completely out of hand. The commission does nothing equivalent itself. And so people can see the contrast. People can see the contrast between a human rights analysis and an analysis that seems designed to excuse as many potential wrongdoers as possible. And of course, we may all, and this is for a different podcast, have our critiques of what human rights discourse can and cannot do. But at the very least, it starts from a position of considering whether the state might have an obligation, as opposed to starting from a position of doing everything possible to avoid finding a state obligation. And so I think people who participated in the CLAN project themselves have already noticed the difference between how they were treated by that project and how they were subsequently treated when they went to the commission. And I think that tension and that contrast is very important for public discourse and public understanding, because the CLAN project has shown how it should have been done on a much smaller scale.
Well, exactly. And I would suggest the commission's report shows how not to do it.
Quite right. Quite right. Yeah.
We will include a link to all articles and reports mentioned in today's episode on the UK Human Rights blog. But all that it leaves me to do is to say thank you so much, Mairead, for coming on the podcast and summarising for our listeners this incredibly lengthy and complex report.
Thank you for having me.
LawPod UK was presented by Emma Louise Fenlon and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.